This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. If you've been on social media in the past few months, you've probably come across posts, photos or videos of the currently ongoing trial between Amber Heard and Johnny Depp. And while it's actually a defamation trial, much of it revolves around accusations of domestic violence from both sides. And what their fans or supporters have been posting online in response to this ongoing trial has been, in many cases, quite disturbing and triggering for some people as well. So with how widely it's being talked about online, we want to discuss today how might this impact survivors of domestic violence or other forms of intimate partner violence, or even people who are still stuck in those relationships. So joining me on today's show to weigh in on this is Sumitra Viswanathan, the Executive Director of Women's Aid Organization, or commonly known as WAO. How are you doing today, Sumitra?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
I think to start, right, what impressions have you gotten so far from how the trial between these two celebrities, Amber Heard and Johnny Depp, are being covered both in the mainstream media, but also what have you seen based on what people are posting on social media?
From what I see on social media, it looks to me like hate. It looks to me like hate speech, and it looks a lot like misogyny. There are so many layers and levels to this case, but also so many layers and levels to how the case is being represented in the media and how people are talking about it in the media. There is a preponderance of social media posts that are derogatory, derisory, and demeaning towards Amber Heard. And, you know, in what I'm saying, I'm not actually, you know, going to address who's lying and who's not lying and who's the abuser and who's the survivor. It's not about that. It's simply about looking at the sort of messaging and the sort of views that are coming out in social media. It's hate speech, I feel. It's misogynistic. It is demeaning. It is degrading. And it is extremely damaging towards survivors.
Now, like you said, right, it's such a complicated case. There are layers to it. And we're not here to comment on the case itself. But with something as high profile as this, and from what we've heard, you know, it's been quite disturbing, to say the least. We've seen a lot of finger pointing happening online. We've seen people taking sides, you know, people creating people creating hashtags to, you know, maliciously comment against either sides, people reenacting scenes or fixating on the smallest details that, you know, either of them say in court. In some cases, even conspiracy theories, right? It's almost become a form of entertainment for some people online. Do you think that detracts from the conversation that there was a domestic violence case at the heart of this issue? And is it trivializing the issue of domestic or intimate partner violence?
Absolutely. And I think in all of the reporting around this case, in my view, it is the issue of intimate partner violence that has itself become the casualty. IPV, intimate partner violence, domestic violence, is a scourge on our society, and it is endemic. In Malaysia, for instance, the last sort of scientific study that was done was in 2014, mm-hmm. and it found that 1 in 10 ever-partnered women in Malaysia is currently or has previously been a survivor of domestic violence. So what does that mean? That means if you get a group of 10 women, you line them up, one out of those 10 women has been a survivor of domestic violence. And that is widespread. And that is Malaysia. Worldwide, 1 in 3 women have been survivors of gender-based violence. It is endemic. And when you see this kind of reporting with so many myths being perpetrated, it really has the impact of trivializing such a fundamentally damaging, personally destructive occurrence, not just for an individual, but, you know, for communities and for society as a whole, it trivializes the whole thing. And that's why I say that in the reporting that we've seen, the casualty is the issue of intimate partner violence. But, you know, it's if I may just add to that, organizations like Women's Aid Organization and, you know, so many others who are part of also the gender, the Joint Action Group for Gender Equality, we have spent decades informing the public, addressing myths, trying to get society to understand its prevalence, and also try to get us, to encourage us to confront our own biases and misperceptions and society's fundamental flaw, the sense that we believe women are less equal than men. We do so much to try and dispel myths and raise awareness. And a case like this, it just basically demonstrates that we have a lot more work to do to address these fundamental biases in society. It is the misogyny that comes out like a monster. That is the monster in this case, the misogyny. It can be demoralizing also, you know, for activists like those of us in WAO.
You mentioned it's perpetuating myths surrounding intimate partner violence. Could you elaborate more on that? What sort of myths or stereotypes are you seeing being, you know, perpetuated in this case?
Okay. Number one, the whole idea of the perfect victim. It's been said by other, you know, activists that, you know, in the way society blames women, blames victims and judges victims, it's almost as if the perfect victim is the dead victim, the woman who has died as a result of domestic violence, intimate partner violence. She's that perfect victim. She's the victim that society wants to see. But the reality is we, none of us are perfect, right? But fundamentally, we all have the right to live a life free from violence, all of us. So that whole idea of the perfect victim is something that society really buys into. And therefore, when someone makes a claim of intimate partner violence, if there's even a suggestion of some kind of action that may be seen to be faulty, then it seriously counts against the survivor. That's one. The other one is, why didn't she leave? If he indeed was abusing her, if he indeed had, you know, committed sexual violence on her and so forth, why didn't she leave? That is, you know, one of the most common perceptions, you know, when it comes to domestic violence. Number one, why didn't she leave? And number two, if it was serious enough, she would have left. And number three is, if it was me, I would have left. And, you know, we do so much work to try and address that, to get our communities to understand why it's so hard to walk away from an abusive relationship, not just because of the economic dependence that usually occurs, but also because of the very nature of intimate partner violence, that whole issue of the cycle of violence. And then the other myth is, you know, the other misconception is, but he was so good to you. He gave you things. He bought you things. He resourced you. He resourced your friends. But, you know, that's the, again, that cycle of violence, you know, where you have, you know, that lovey-dovey honeymoon period, and then, you know, you have the increasing tensions, and then you have a trigger, and then you have a DV incident, and then you have that incredible remorse. And then it keeps going round and round in a circle. So, but he's so nice. And then the other myth is, there's so many myths, right? The other one is, he could never, I don't believe this man is an abuser, because, you know, he was so nice to me when I knew him, or because I know him, I work with him. I, you know, he's my neighbor, he's whatever. he's a really nice man. I don't believe this. He could possibly have done it. And, you know, what an individual presents to the world at large and how they act with an intimate partnership can be two very different things. That's just, you know, just a few of the myths that seem to be coming up all the time in this reporting. Yeah.
Mm. So Mitra, could intimate partner violence happen both ways? Could someone both be an abuser and a victim at the same time?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. There can be, abuse perpetrated by both parties on each other. But the thing to remember about, if you make a finding of domestic violence, is that it's fundamentally about the issue of power and control.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, usually within a relationship, there is one party who holds the power, who's more empowered, and who tries to take control away from the other party. Okay, so then this also comes up a lot in the context of, can men also be survivors of domestic violence?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is absolutely, absolutely yes. So if I can try and explain it by looking at it in various layers. So you have, if you look at it at society level, and within society, I think, you know, we all of us probably will not dispute that men and women are unequal in society, right? Men are more empowered to claim rights, women less so. So you have that kind of disparity in society that gets imported into intimate relationships, partnerships, and society supports the man's position to claim more rights. So there is a likelihood an enabling environment where he's able to claim more power and therefore able to take control away from the woman. So that's on the society level. But each intimate partnership is different, right? And there are always certain circumstances that are unique in particular to a certain relationship. And within that relationship, there could be a situation where, you know, power is predisposed towards one gender within the partnership rather than the other, right? So if it's a same-sex relationship, it's possible that, you know, power shifts on the basis, not necessarily of gender, but, you know, it could be other circumstances. Or there could be also be a situation where, you know, the woman within the partnership claims that power and takes away control from the male partner. Yes, of course, it does happen, but it happens to a lesser degree, to a lesser extent than the reverse.
All right. Let's go for a quick break now, Sumitra, and continue our discussion when we come back. I'm speaking today to the Executive Director of Women's Aid Organization, or WAO, Sumitra Viswanathan, and we're talking about the ongoing defamation trial between Amber Heard and Johnny Depp and how that has implications when it comes to work that has been done for decades when it comes to gender-based violence and domestic violence. We'll continue our discussion after a few messages. Keep it here on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. Joining me on the show today is Sumitra Viswanathan, Executive Director of Women's Aid Organization, and we are talking about the implications on survivors of domestic violence as a result of the media coverage, as well as social media coverage of the ongoing trial between Amber Heard and Johnny Depp. And, you know, before the break, we were talking a bit about how the social media posts that their fans, their supporters have put up online are really quite disturbing and triggering. And Sumitra, there's something that I found, I want to say interesting, but maybe that's not quite the right word. But like you say, we saw a lot more content being posted against Amber Heard in particular, you know, and I've seen videos or people reenacting what she said in court fixating over the smallest details that don't add up, you know, to discredit each party, people making memes or TikToks, you know, or analysing Amber Heard's face frame by frame or how she's reacted to things. This is a high-profile case, but is it common for women especially to be subject to such scrutiny? What are the problems with this kind of behaviour that we see?
Yeah, it is common. And in WAO's experience of supporting survivors, when a domestic violence issue is being adjudicated in court, the tendency always is to put that kind of focus on the woman who's making the claim, you know, in criminal cases, etc. There's always that whole thing of what did you do, you know, and how are you reacting right now?
Mm-hmm.
And being really judged on the basis of how you're presenting your claim of domestic violence. It's highly problematic, Suan, and it has a chilling effect on other survivors of violence, and specifically, you know, women survivors of violence. It absolutely will have a chilling effect and may stop them from coming forward,
mm-hmm.
To seek justice, to seek support, because they are afraid of not just being disbelieved, but afraid of being ridiculed. The level of ridicule that has been, heaped on Amber Heard in this case is shocking. It is absolutely shocking. It's misogynistic. It is demeaning. And I think it's really been unprecedented. And it seems to have unleashed waves upon waves upon waves of misogyny. It's almost like, you know, the kind of the deeply embedded perceptions and deeply embedded cultural biases against women. It's almost as if this case has given it a platform to come out without being judged, mm-hmm. itself, right? So there seems to be worldwide acceptance of this kind of tawdry and unsupported hate being heaped upon the woman survivor or the claimant in this case. It's like license to ridicule, and it has a chilling effect. If I can just talk about one statistic,
mm-hmm.
A couple of years ago, YouGov did a survey on sexual harassment in Malaysia. And I'll say these surveys are really few and far between. We have very little credible research on GBV in Malaysia. But YouGov did this survey. And over a third of Malaysian women have faced sexual harassment. But out of this number, more than half have said that they will not report it because they fear embarrassment. So you see, this is a fear that's already present,
mm-hmm.
in survivors. And when they see this kind of demonstration on social media, you know, it just makes it a lot worse. Fewer women are going to come forward and seek support and seek justice for, you know, the violence and abuse that they face.
Mm. What if someone comes out and say, well, I'm saying these things against Amber Heard in this case because I think she's in the wrong and, you know, people are just overreacting because, or saying that, you know, my comments are misogynistic because she's a woman, you know, how do we tackle that?
Okay, so you can break down the kind of messaging or rather the kind of representations that are being made. So, you know, it's not about whether you believe Amber Heard or you believe Johnny Depp. It's not about that. It's about how you portray individuals,
mm-hmm.
or in trying to justify your disbelief, it's how you portray that individual. And, you know, I've seen pictures of you know, where her face has been kind of manipulated to look like a witch. I've seen those with, like, you know, the long Pinocchio nose. And it's very gendered. And also, if you read a lot of the stuff that comes up, it's extremely gendered. So, you know, and I was actually just thinking and having a chat with my colleague, and we were wondering, okay, so, you know, when you have these measurement scales, you know, for social media to look at, okay, you know, how much of this is negative towards Amber Heard, how much of this is negative towards Johnny Depp? Do we ever measure across the board, regardless of whether it's pro or for one or the other? Do we measure the level of hate? Do we measure the level of misogyny? Do we measure the level, you know, the level of abuse that is actually being represented in these social media postings? Not about pro this and for and against the other. But, and I think if you measure the level of misogyny with a scale, perhaps, that is specific to that in a gendered way, you will find that it's really off the charts.
And some of it is so subtle as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, this situation perhaps is more on the extreme end because it involves celebrities, right? People with, you know, who are very well known. But do you think it would then lend to some people's arguments that intimate partner violence shouldn't be spoken out loud, shouldn't be discussed in public, you know, to not, quote unquote, air your dirty laundry, because then it becomes something like this where everyone knows and everyone is in your business?
Yeah, that could be put forward as an argument. But, you know, the thing is that in and of itself, I think a televised trial, it could be argued that it's a good thing because, you know, it has a lot of teachable moments for us all, not just for law students, but also, you know, also for those of us who are activists, but also members of the public. And you know, when you hear survivor stories, etc., you know, there's a lot of resonance and recognition. Oh, I faced that. Oh, I know someone who went through that. You know, so there's a lot of teachable moments there. And so in and of itself, that's not a bad thing. But what is the bad thing is the way in which it's being discussed and represented in social media, and the level of, you know, normalization of violence, normalization of control within relationships, and it's just appalling. It's just absolutely appalling. And there was one TikTok, I think, where you know, Amber Heard was talking about how she was, you know, a certain sequence of how she was hit. Mm-hmm. And then there were a whole bunch of people who were reenacting that in a comical way.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the most damaging pieces, I think. I'm not saying damaging to Amber Heard or damaging to Johnny Depp or whatever, but damaging to the whole issue of intimate partner violence and how serious it is as a scourge in our society and what we need to do to end it.
Now, some people might say that, oh, they're just reenacting it. They're not showing something that actually happened. But how could that be triggering for someone who is or who was in an abusive relationship?
I would say on so many levels, but I can think of two.
Mm-hmm.
So someone who may have been hit, perhaps in the same way, and seeing that being depicted is in and of itself would kind of trigger the trauma that you already have.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, is seeing that being reenacted in a way that is intended to be ridiculed, you know, in a ridiculing way, that is so demeaning and devaluing, and that can also be very seriously triggering.
So let's talk about reporting of intimate partner violence cases now, right? And I'll get to social media in a bit, but if we first look at mainstream media, now we know it's important for such cases to be reported. You know, media plays such an important role in when it comes to raising awareness, when it comes to having the facts down. But how What are some, I guess, guidelines or what are some ethical guidelines that journalists should keep in mind when reporting on domestic violence cases? You know, what are some do's and don'ts, regardless of whether, you know, the person that you're reporting on is well known or not?
Yeah, so judgment, you know, using judgy language. You know, it's things like there was a, you know, a case previously where a woman who had left her husband and, you know, and was in a relationship with another person, and then the husband came and attacked her. And that whole thing was represented as, you know, jealous husband because of unfaithful wife, when actually it is a situation of violence against women, you mm-hmm. know. So looking at the finding a justification and using that as the thrust of the reporting.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, he hit her. He hit her because, you know what, she did that. So that kind of judgment, you know, is judgment in reporting is prevalent. And actually, we should step away from it. WAO actually is right now in the process of embarking on a project for gender responsive reporting, you know, understanding and understanding the situation around domestic violence and intimate partner violence and other forms of gender-based violence, and how it should and could be reported on. And I would say that the inherent biases that we have, gender biases that we have, comes out very, very strongly in the media with reporting, especially reporting of news.
Hmm. So then if we move towards social media, right? Now, that's a grey area, you know. In the media, at least, you have journalists who are expected or held up to ethical guidelines in some cases. But on social media, it's really a free-for-all, right? Barring, you know, reporting posts that are harmful or that are inciting hate speech or things like that, what should people keep in mind before posting or sharing any gender-based violence-related content?
Yeah, I think number one is confidentiality, right? It's about protecting identities, especially of the survivor. Sharing graphic images and videos without the consent of the survivor. And also, you know, just very fundamentally, Suen, that dignity and respect. Respecting people and having that inner sense of dignity, mm-hmm. you know, that preserving an individual's dignity is extremely important. You know, social media is so critically important because, you know, it's an awareness platform. It's a discussion platform. And we want to keep it a free space, but we also want it to be a safe space. And social media, because it is unregulated, this is exactly where our biases, our perceptions, you know, our proclivities tend to come up more pronounced in a way, more pronounced way. And also because we're behind a screen, behind a small screen, a big screen.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow it gives us license to be worse than what we would be in speech. So I think self-regulation is extremely important. I think awareness is extremely important because sometimes people post things because they just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't realize the kind of damage that it can cause. So we all have a responsibility to create awareness. We have a responsibility to towards empathy, some level of self-regulation, and also just basic fundamental respect for the other. It's just so important.
Hmm. Do you still see social media as a safe space for people to speak up about issues like intimate partner violence, or are you worried that we might be regressing?
Oh, yeah. I worry that we are regressing. It is an important space. It should be a safe space.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a safe space right now? No. I feel that, you know, social media owners, companies, I think they are trying to do, you know, their bit to monitor, you know, usage and respond to reports of abuse and so forth. But it's just simply not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And it cannot match the scale of the usage of those platforms. I think it's so important for us to continue the work to raise awareness within society, to challenge biases, to break down regressive norms. And we, all of us, have a part to play in that, all of us.
Mm. I've once heard from someone that, you know, would you think about whether you would say what you post to someone in person? And I felt like that has been really great advice in thinking, you know, am I using my anonymity online as a barrier, you know, to say things that really you should think twice before posting? And I feel like that's been great advice for me. And on that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Sumitra.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Siwen.
I've been speaking to Sumitra Viswanathan, Executive Director of the Women's Aid Organization, and we've been talking about how media coverage, especially social media coverage of the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp trial, has been affecting domestic violence survivors, as well as conversations about domestic violence in general. If you missed any part of today's show or any previous Live and Learn episodes, you can download our podcasts on bfm.my or on the BFM app. I'm Lim Suan, and this has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.